I'm Carlos Virgen, and this is The Storyline, produced by The Day in New London, Connecticut. This week, I talked to Julia Bergman about a 7-hour rescue at sea of a wounded submarine sailor. She also takes us up the Connecticut River on a Coast Guard icebreaking mission as accumulated ice prompted emergency conditions in at least one town. Finally, Martha Shanahan gives us the latest update on the much-debated future of the Seaside Regional Center property in Waterford. Tell me about the shooting on the USS North Dakota and the response by emergency personnel, both on the submarine and on land.
Sure. So yeah, about a week ago, a sailor on the USS North Dakota attempted to commit suicide while the submarine was out to sea. And in reporting on that from a breaking news perspective and also just following it in the days afterward, it became pretty clear that there was a really extensive response involved. I should say right off the bat that the sailor is, last we heard, was in stable condition and expected to obviously pull through.
So on the submarine, what kind of medical assistance is available?
Right. So the sailor shot himself around 5 p.m. one Friday night. And on board of submarine, there's a corpsman who is the submarine's version of a doctor, although people more compare that person's training to a physician's assistant or their sort of, you know, what they can do to a physician, what a physician assistant can do. So, you know, this person can triage patients and things like that. So the corpsman led a team of sailors who helped treat this guy and stabilize him. You know, some other sailors held a phone up to him, his face, so that he could watch music videos when he was lucid. Parts of the submarine were actually disassembled. Certain sailors disassembled parts of the submarine so they could help get this guy off more comfortably in a stretcher. So there was a real, you know, on board the submarine, the guy, from the time the guy shot himself until he got in an ambulance at Fort Trumbull was about 7 hours. So, you know, the crew spent several hours trying to facilitate his, you know, his inevitable transfer off the submarine.
So this happens on the sub. The call goes to the base alerting them, and that puts in motion emergency personnel.
So multiple people were obviously notified. You know, people were telling me, you know, emergency responders and other people were telling me how their phones were sort of blowing up, ringing, because given that the submarine was out to sea, there was a lot of back and forth about initially, you know, where the submarine even was, but also, you know, what the best way to respond was going to be. You know, some sailors on board actually set up for a really complicated helicopter transfer in case that was needed. And, you know, it's worth noting that the weather that night was pretty awful. It was the fog was incredibly dense. It was, you know, dark, obviously, because it was nighttime. There was, you know, there was rain. Winds were pretty intense. So, you know, it was less than perfect conditions, obviously.
So emergency responders on land are getting ready to go out to meet the submarine, and that including the ship pilot, which is typically the person who navigates the submarine into the port.
Right. So so a team of four people from the sub-base fire department went out on a tugboat, one of the Ranalski tugboats, with ship pilot Richard Willett. He's the ship pilot for the base, so he handles all the, you know, submarine and military vessel traffic coming in and out of there.
Lights on both sides of the river. Okay. I lost the lights on the bridge at about a half a mile out. Okay. So I'll say they were half a mile or three quarters visibility. And I'm okay to bring this up through the bridge and everything and up to the base with that. And then from there, though, it just decreased. We couldn't see the rudder from the sail.
So they went out on the tug, and the firefighters brought a variety of equipment because they didn't really know exactly, you know, what it was going to be like getting this guy out of the submarine in the middle of the sea. It was something they've never done before, you know, out at sea at night in dense fog, like I said.
Rough weather.
Rough seas.
Normally go to a submarine, we'll bring a 15 fireman to get somebody out of a submarine. We're now going to take a tugboat to the mouth of the river, or wherever. I don't even know where you took me to, because the fog was so thick. I saw a green light blinking, because I was off the buoy at one point, I knew that. So knowing that we did not have our typical resources to turn around and I could just tell somebody, hey, go back to the squad and get something, or go back to the ambulance. We had to bring enough equipment, hoping for the best that this guy could walk out, knowing that it could be the worst case scenario that when we get out there. So
luckily, and one of the guys called it a home run. The original hatch that they were, the submarines have hatches, and the original hatch that this guy was going to come out of would have involved much more complex maneuvering, and luckily they ended up taking him out of the weapons hatch, which made for a much smoother, getting him out, because he was, first of all, just within 6 feet of that hatch, so they only had to lift, 6 feet. But also, they were able to take him out at an angle, because that's the way that, since the weapons hatch, weapons are loaded, at a diagonal. Right. So that really helped make it, a very complex situation a little bit easier. Yeah.
The submarine was about 150 nautical miles?
Yeah, about 150 nautical miles away. So, not extremely close by.
Right, right.
And so the ship's, navigation and driving team had to find the fastest route possible back. And, like I said, traversed, heavy seas and at night, to get back, as quickly as possible.
And then the difficulty once the tugboat got near the submarine to actually even see the submarine.
Right. So they barely could even see the submarine. So the tugboat actually let the submarine pass it and then came at it from behind because they could see the stern lights and went at it that way. And then, as they normally do, put the sort of ladder across and
sailors were on the submarine with lights and
So sailors were topside on the submarine, flashing lights. They braved the storm to flash lights so that the tugboat could see them.
And so now they get the sailor on the tugboat.
Yep. So they got the rendezvous between the tug and the submarine happened right at the mouth of the Thames, and they were able to get, as I said, the sailor out pretty easily thanks to him coming out of the weapons hatch and, just all the, obviously, manpower involved in that.
Mike went through and he tightened it up the first time we got ready to move. And then I went through it, and as I moved up from his feet to his head, I got towards his head and I looked around and said, this is going to hurt.
Yeah.
Because we can't have you falling out of this.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to be making a move. He's like, all right, you got to do what you got to do.
What they did was they packed the entry wound, mm-hmm. And it pretty much started to scab or started to clot. When we started to manipulate him a little bit and the doctor started working on him, he started to bleed out of the exit wound pretty profusely. So that's when we packed the exit wound with the trauma dressings.
They got him off the submarine in about 15 to 20 minutes, which is, pretty quick. And they put him in the pilot house of the tugboat and off they went and were to Fort Trumbull within 5 minutes.
Where there was an ambulance.
Where there was all sorts of medical personnel waiting for him who had been waiting there for, several hours, because they weren't quite sure when he was going to be there, when they were going to get there and all that. And then once he got into the ambulance at Fort Trumbull, he was to the hospital within 2 minutes.
Where was he transported?
He was transported first to Lawrence and Memorial Hospital in New London, and then later to Yale New Haven. Yale New Haven Hospital.
And the latest is that he was in stable condition.
Yeah, the latest we heard was that he was in stable condition and, expected to pull through. The commanding officer of the North Dakota actually posted on Facebook about, detailing the crew's response. That post has actually since been deleted, but, we did see it before it was deleted, and I just wanted to read, one line from that post, which in which Robinson says, quote, I can't truly express the amount of heroism I saw in the last 48 hours. As a result, the sailor is recovering from surgery in a hospital in New Haven with his parents by his side, unquote.
Amazing story. Thank you.
Yeah, really quite a heroic effort.
What does leave work now mean to you? What does it imply?
It implies that wherever you're sitting listening to this, it is not as fun as what you could be doing.
Exactly. We're the harbingers of relaxation.
It's your job every day to go and do what other people would consider fun. So this podcast is sort of like going along with you.
You want to go with me the next time I attend a Yanni concert?
Leave work now with Rick Koster. Find us on theday.com or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
As a result of some of the winter weather that we've been experiencing, the freezing cold, and we've had some issues on the Connecticut River with ice building up at certain points, right, at some of the bridges. So the Coast Guard icebreakers were called out, and you happened to ride on one of them yesterday?
Some really impressive pictures coming out of the ice on the Connecticut River. I mean, really, it looks almost like it's covered in mini icebergs. And so earlier in the week, the Coast Guard cutter Bollard, which is a small ice-breaking tug that's based in New Haven, was trying to work its way through the ice and realized it probably needed some help, and you know, that the ice was just too thick, and so it turned around, and the Coast Guard called in another ice-breaking tug, the exact same, you know, same size and weight and all that, from actually Bayonne, New Jersey, just across from New York City. So that cutter, Hauser, came up on Wednesday, and then the two cutters on Thursday made their way down the Connecticut River very slowly. They were feeling a little discouraged. They went out twice, once in the late morning and again in the late afternoon Thursday, and they were feeling a bit discouraged after the first go-around because, you know, they had cut up a bunch of ice and then it sort of filled in around them, so their work kind of got diminished. But, you know, they were back at it and sort of made a little bit of progress more later in the day.
So breaking the ice is literally they just cut through, they...
Yeah,
plow
so
the
these icebreakers, their hulls are sort of designed for this. You know, they come up, put a lot of pressure on the ice, and then back up and sort of ram into it again, all very slowly. I mean, we're talking like 1-2 knots here.
What was that like being on the boat? I mean, the sound.
It's really loud. You know, you hear the sound of the ice sort of crunching very noisily below you. You know, it's obviously a little bit of a bumpy ride. The motor, the engine's pretty loud.
How successful do you think do they think they were?
They were feeling okay about their efforts. I mean, they're sort of the Hauser, the officer in charge of the Hauser wasn't really sure when they were going to be going back to Bayonne. I think they were planning on at least a couple more days, full days, you know, once the sun is up, going out there again until the sun sets. And they weren't exactly sure. You know, both crews actually slept on their boats last night so that to facilitate, you know, getting up early in the morning and just getting right at it again.
The town of Hamden was asking for assistance, right? They were concerned.
Yeah,
that they
so this prompted, you know, the ice jams were so bad that the town of Hamden, the first select woman there, declared that due to the flooding and ice dams, a condition of danger to life. There was there was danger to life and property. A copy of that declaration was sent to Governor Malloy, and with the hopes that he would declare the town to be a state in emergency. And if that happens, then they're eligible for state and federal assistance.
So it looks like this will require some more work by the
definitely, ice cutters. Definitely. Yeah, it's not nowhere near done.
Let's see the latest on Seaside.
The Seaside Regional Center. Yeah. Also known as the Seaside Tuberculosis
Sanatorium.
Yeah. It's sort of basically the latest bureaucratic update in a long bureaucratic story, which is what the state is going to do with this huge property that it has in Waterford. Governor Malloy announced that it would be turned into a state park in 2014, and so they've sort of spent the years since then figuring out how to do that and how much it's going to cost and what they think that should look like. And the sort of design that they've come up with that they think is optimal for it is a model in which a private company would come in and renovate the buildings there, which are of historical value because they were designed by the architect Gilbert Cass. Kind of a big deal in the sort of historic preservation architecture world. So this private hotel company or a development company would come in and redevelop these buildings and restore them so that they can be used as a hotel that would then be managed privately, and the property would still continue to be owned by the state. They scale down the idea of what it's going to look like and the number of rooms that they think they can fit in there. Before, it had been at 100 at one point. In this latest decision that the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection gave to another state agency, they have scaled it back to 63 rooms, which should alleviate some of the traffic concerns that people had. Everyone kind of has a different opinion about this. I mean, you have the historic preservationists, you know, I'm sure this is a sort of a victory for them. They, you know, want to see any plan that keeps the buildings standing and restored. The neighbors have a variety of opinions about that. Most of them don't really want to see something that's going to bring more cars coming in. The first selectman of Waterford has said that he would rather they go back to reconsidering selling it to a private developer, which was the plan for a while before the governor made his announcement about it being a state park. So the document that they submitted to the state also sort of hedges it a little bit and says that, you know, they can also change their mind if the hotel chain comes in and says that 63 rooms isn't enough. They might go back to the drawing board and go back to up to 100, or if the hotel company or, you know, whatever private developer they get says they don't think a hotel is viable, then they'll go back to one of the other plans, which involves no hotel. So it's not a final ruling by any point. There's still a lot of evaluation and hemming and hawing to be done about what it's going to look like eventually. So I don't think we'll know exactly what the deal will be for a while.